by accident while cleaning a pistol. But the item pointed out that the accident happened less than 12 hours after his father's death. That it might actually have been suicide was left for the reader to imply. "I don't think it was suicide," Katie said. Beneath her makeup, she looked very pale. "I don't think it was exactly an accident either. It homes in on the names, Mike. You see that, right? And it can't spell, which makes it even worse." The obit, I was coming to loathe that word, below the piece about Wicked Ken's son, concerned one Kenneth Wanderlee, L-E-E instead of L-Y, of Paramus, New Jersey. Like Peter Stefano of Pennsylvania, an innocent who had probably never killed anything but time, Wanderlee of Paramus had died of a heart attack, just like Jeroma. I was breathing fast and sweating all over. My balls had drawn up until they felt roughly the size of peach pits. I felt like fainting, also like vomiting, and managed to do neither, although I did plenty of vomiting later. That went on for a week or more, and I lost 10 pounds. I told my worried mother it was the flu. "Here's the capper," she said, and handed me the last page. There were 17 Amos Langfords on it. The biggest cluster was in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, but one had died in Baltimore, one in Virginia, and two had kicked off in West Virginia. In Florida, there were 3. "No," I whispered. "Yes," she said. "This second one in Amityville is Penny's bad uncle. Just be grateful that Amos is also a fairly unusual name in this day and age. If it had been James or William, there would have been hundreds of dead Langfords, probably not thousands, because it's still not reaching farther than the Midwest, but Florida's 900 miles away, farther than any AM radio signal can reach, at least in the daytime." The sheets of paper slipped from my hand and seesawed to the floor. "Now do you see what I meant about those squeezy things people use to make their hands and arms stronger? At first, maybe you can only squeeze the handles together once or twice, but if you keep doing it, the muscles get stronger. That's what's happening to you, Mike. I'm sure of it. Every time you write an obit for a living person, the power gets stronger and reaches farther." "It was your idea," I whispered. "Your goddamn idea." But she wasn't having that. "I didn't tell you to write Jeroma's obituary. That was your idea." "It was a whim," I protested. "A goof, for God's sake. I didn't know what was going to happen." Only maybe that wasn't the truth. I flashed back to my first orgasm in the bathtub, assisted by a bubbly handful of Ivory soap. I hadn't known what I was doing when I reached down and grabbed myself. Only some part of me, some deep, instinctual part, had known. There's another old adage, this one not Ben Franklin's. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Sometimes the teacher is inside us. "Wanderlee was your idea," I pointed out. "So was Amos the Midnight Creeper. And by then you knew what was going to happen." She sat on the edge of the desk, her desk now, and looked at me straight on, which couldn't have been easy.
"That much is true. But Mike, I didn't know it was going to spread."
"Neither did I.
And it really is addictive. I was sitting next to you when you did it, and it was like breathing secondhand crack."
"I can stop," I said, hoping, hoping.
"Are you sure?"
"Pretty. Now here's one for you. Can you keep your mouth shut about this, like for the rest of your life?" She did me the courtesy of thinking it over. Then she nodded.
"I have to. I could have a good thing here at Circus, and I don't want to bitch it up before I can get on my feet."
It was all about her, in other words. And what else could I have expected? Katie might not be sucking on Jeroma's eucalyptus drops. I could have been wrong about that. But she was sitting in Jeroma's chair, behind Jeroma's desk. Plus that new look-but-don't-touch-tumbly hairdo. As Orwell's pigs might have said, blue jeans good, new dress better. What about Penny? Katie said nothing. Because my impression of Penny, everybody's impression of Penny, in fact, is that she doesn't have all four wheels on the road. Katie's eyes flashed.
Are you surprised? She had an extremely traumatic childhood, in case you missed it. A nightmare childhood.
I can relate, because I'm living my own nightmare right now. So save the support group empathy. I just want to know if she'll keep her mouth shut, like forever. Will she? There was a long, long pause. At last, Katie said,
now that he's dead, maybe she'll stop going to the rape survivor meetings.
And if she doesn't?
I guess she might, at some point, tell someone who's in especially bad shape that she knows a guy who could help that someone get closure. She wouldn't do it this month, and probably not this year, but...
She didn't finish. We looked at each other. I was sure she could read what I was thinking in my eyes. There was one sure-shot, never-miss way to make sure Penny kept her mouth shut.
No,
Katie said.
Don't even think of it. And not only because she deserves her life and whatever good things there might be for her up ahead. It wouldn't be just her.
Based on her research, she was right about that. Penny Langston wasn't a super common name either, but there are more than 300 million people in America, and some of the Penny or Penelope Langstons out there would win a very bad lottery if I decided to power up my laptop or iPad and write a new obit. Then there was the in-the-neighborhood effect. The power had taken a Wander Lee, L-E-E, as well as a Wander Lee, L-Y. What if it decided to take Petula Langstons, Patsy Langfords, Penny Langleys? Then there was my own situation. It might take only one more obit for Michael Anderson to surrender completely to that high-voltage buzz. Just thinking about it made me want to do it. Because it would take away, if only temporarily, these feelings of horror and dismay. I pictured myself writing an obituary for John Smith or Jill Jones to cheer myself up, and my balls shriveled even more at the thought of the mass carnage that could follow.
What are you going to do?
Katie asked. I'll think of something, I said. I did. That night I opened a Rand McNally Road Atlas to the big map of the United States, closed my eyes, and dropped my finger. Which is why I now live in Laramie, Wyoming, where I'm a house painter. Primarily a house painter. I actually have a number of jobs, like many people in the small cities of the heartland, what I used to refer to, with a New Yorker's casual contempt, as flyover country. I also work part-time for a landscaping company, mowing lawns, raking leaves, and planting bushes. In the winter, I plow out driveways and work at the Snowy Range Ski Resort, grooming trails. I'm not rich, but I keep my head above water. A little more above it than in New York, actually. Make fun of flyover country all you want to, but it's a lot cheaper to live out here. And whole days go by without anyone giving me the finger. My parents don't understand why I chucked it all, and my father doesn't try to hide his disappointment. He sometimes talks about my Peter Pan lifestyle and says I'm going to regret it when I turn 40 and start seeing gray in my hair. My mother is just as puzzled but less disapproving. She never liked Neon Circus. Thought it was a sleazy waste of my authorial abilities. She was probably right on both counts. But what I mostly use my authorial abilities for these days is jotting grocery lists. As for my hair, I saw the first strands of gray even before I left the city, and that was before I turned 30. I still dream about writing, though, and these are not pleasant dreams. In one of them, I'm sitting at my laptop, even though I don't own a laptop anymore. I'm writing an obituary, and I can't stop.
In this dream, I don't want to either, because that sense of power had never been stronger. I get as far as, sad news, last night everyone in the world named John died, and then wake up, sometimes on the floor, sometimes rolled up in my blankets and screaming. On a couple of occasions, it's a wonder I didn't wake the neighbors. I never left my heart in San Francisco, but I did leave my laptop in dear old Brooklyn. Couldn't bear to give up my iPad, though. Talk about addictions. I don't use it to send emails. When I want to get in touch with someone in a hurry, I call. If it's not urgent, I use that antique institution known as the United States Post Office. You'd be surprised how easy it is to get back into the habit of writing letters and postcards. I like the iPad, though. There are plenty of games on it, plus the wind sounds that help me get to sleep at night, and the alarm that wakes me up in the morning. I've got tons of stored music, a few audiobooks, lots of movies. When all else fails to entertain, I surf the internet. Endless time-filling possibilities there, as you probably know yourself. And in Laramie, the time can pass slowly when I'm not working, especially in winter. Sometimes I visit the Neon Circus site, just for old time's sake. Katie's doing a good job as editor, much better than Jeroma, who really didn't have much in the way of vision. And the site hovers around number 5 on the list of most visited internet landing spots. Sometimes it's a notch or two above the Drudge Report. Mostly it lurks just below. Plenty of ads, so they're doing well in that regard. Jeroma's successor is still writing her Getting Sloshed with Katie interviews. Frank Jessup is still covering sports. His not-quite-joking piece about wanting to see an all-steroids football league got national attention and landed him a gig on ESPN, Mohawk and all. Georgina Bukowski wrote half a dozen unfunny speaking ill of the dead obituaries, and then Katie shit-canned the column and replaced it with Celebrity Death Stakes, where readers win prizes for predicting which famous people will die in the next 12 months. Penny Langston is the master of ceremonies there, and each week a new smiling headshot of her appears on top of a dancing skeleton. It's Circus's most popular feature, and each week the comments section goes on for pages. People like to read about death, and they like to write about it. I'm someone who knows. Okay, that's the story. I don't expect you to believe it, and you don't have to. This is America, after all. I've done my best to lay it out neatly, just the same. The way I was taught to lay out a story in my journalism classes. Not fancy, not twee, or all highfalutin. I tried to keep it clear in a straight line. Beginning leads to middle, middle leads to end. Old school, you dig? Ducks in a row. And if you find the end a little flat, you might remember Professor Higgins's take on that. He used to say that in reporting, it's always the end for now. And in real life, the only full stop is on the obituary page.
For Stuart Onan. Here's an anecdote too good not to share, and I've been telling it at public appearances for years now. My wife does the major shopping for us. She says there'd never be a vegetable in the house otherwise, but she sometimes sends me on emergency errands. So I was in the local supermarket one afternoon on a mission to find batteries and a nonstick fry pan. As I meandered my way up the housewares aisle, having already stopped for a few other absolute necessities, cinnamon buns and potato chips, a woman came around the far end riding one of those motorized carts. She was a Florida snowbird archetype, about 80, permed to perfection, and as darkly tanned as a Cordovan shoe. She looked at me, looked away, then did a double take. "I know you," she said. "You're Stephen King. You write those scary stories." "That's all right. Some people like them, but not me. I like uplifting stories like that Shawshank Redemption." "I wrote that too," I said. "No, you didn't," she said, and went on her way. The point is, you write some scary stories, and you're like the girl who lives in a trailer park on the edge of town. You get a reputation. Fine by me. The bills are paid, and I'm still having fun. You can call me anything, as the saying goes, just as long as you don't call me late for dinner. But the term genre holds very little interest for me. Yes, I like horror stories. I also love mysteries, tales of suspense, sea stories, straight literary novels, and poetry, just to mention a few. I also like to read and write stories that strike me funny, and that should surprise nobody because humor and horror are Siamese twins. Not long ago, I heard a guy talking about a fireworks arms race on a lake in Maine, and this story came to mind. And please don't think of it as local color, okay? That's another genre I have no use for.
Drunken Fireworks, read by Tim Sample.
Statement given by Mr. Alden McCausland, Castle County Police Department. Statement taken by Police Chief Andrew Clutterbuck. Arresting Officer Ardell Benoit also present. 11:15 a.m. to 1:20 p.m., July 5th, 2015.
Yes, you could say. Mind me, did a good deal of drinking and lounging around out to camp after Daddy died. No law against it, is there? If you don't get behind the wheel, that is, and we never did. We could afford it, too, because by then we were what you might call the idle rich. Never would have expected that, Dad being a carpenter all his life. Called himself a skilled carpenter. And Ma always added, barely skilled and mostly distilled. That was her little joke. Ma worked down to Royce Flowers over on Castle Street, but only full-time in November and December. A dab hand at those Christmas wreaths she was, and not bad when it came to funeral arrangements either. She did Dad, you know. Had a nice yellow ribbon on it that said, "How we love thee." Almost biblical, don't you think? People cried when they saw it. Even ones Dad owed money to. When I got out of high school, I went to work at Sonny's Garage, balancing wheels, doing oil changes and fixing flats. Back in the old days, I used to pump gas, but, of course, now that's all DIY. I also sold some pot, might as well admit it. Haven't done it for years, so I guess you can't charge me on that. But in the 80s, that was a pretty good cash and carry business, especially in these parts. Always had enough jingle to go out stepping on Friday or Saturday night. I enjoy the company of women, but have stayed away from the altar, at least so far. I guess if I have any ambitions, one would be to see the Grand Canyon, and another would be to stay what they call a lifelong bachelor. Less problems that way. Besides, I got to keep an eye on Ma. You know what they say. A boy's best friend is his... I will get to the point, Adele, but if you want it, you have to let me tell it my own way. If anyone should have a little sympathy for telling the whole story, it's you. When we was in school together, you wouldn't shut up. Tongue hung in the middle and running at both ends, Mrs. Fitch used to say. Remember her? Fourth grade? What a cad she was. Remember the time you put gum in the toe of a shoe? where was I? Camp, right? Out on Abenaki Lake. Ain't nothing but a three-room cabin with a lick of beach and an old dock. Daddy bought it in 91, I think it was, when he run into a little dividend from some job. That wasn't enough for the down payment, but when I added in the income from my herbal remedies, we was able to swing it. The place is pretty skeevy, though. I'm willing to admit that. Ma called it the Mosquito Bowl. We never fixed it up worth a tin shit, but Daddy kept to the payments pretty regular. When he missed, mind me chipped in. She bitched about giving away her flower money, but never too hard. She liked going out there from the first, bugs, leaky roof and all. We'd sit out on the deck, have a picnic lunch, watch the world go by. Even then, she wouldn't say no to a six-pack or a bottle of coffee brandy, although in those days she kept her drinking mostly to the weekends. The place was all paid off around the turn of the century, and why not? It was on the town side of the lake, the west side, and you both know what it's like over there. All reedy and shallow, plenty of pucker brush. The east side's nicer, them big houses the summer people have to have. And I imagine they looked across the slums on our side, all shacks and cabins and trailer homes, and told themselves it was a shame how the locals had to live without so much as a tennis court to their names. Well, they could think whatever they wanted. Far as we was concerned, we're as good as anybody. Dad'd fish a little off the end of the dock, and Ma would cook what he caught on the wood stove, and after 01, or maybe it was 02, we had the running water and no longer had to trot to the outhouse in the middle of the night. Good as anybody. We thought there'd be a little more money for fixing up once the place was paid off, but there never seemed to be. The way it disappeared was a mystery, because back then there were plenty of bank loans for people who wanted to build, and Daddy was working regular. When he died of a heart attack while on a job in Harlow in 02, that was, Ma and me thought we was pretty well skint.
"We'll get by, though," she said. "And if it was Hawes he was spending the extra on, I don't want to know."
But she said we'd have to sell the place on Abenaki if we could find somebody crazy enough to buy it.
"We'll get showing it next spring," she said, "before the black flies hatch out. That okay with you, Alden?"
I said it was, and even went to work sprucing it up. Got as far as new shingles, and replacing the worst of the rotted boards on the dock, and that's when we had our first stroke of luck. Ma got a call from an insurance company down to Portland, and found out why there never seemed to be any extra money, even after the cabin and the 2 acres it stood on was paid off. It wasn't Hawes. Dad had been putting the extra into life insurance. Maybe he had what you call a premonition. Stranger things happened in the world every day, like rains of frogs or two-headed cat I seen down at the Castle County Fair. Gave me nightmares, it did, or that Loch Ness monster. Whatever it was, we had $75,000 that we never expected just drop out of the sky and into our key bank account. That was stroke of luck number one. 2 years after that call, 2 years almost to the day, here come stroke of luck number two. Ma was in the habit of buying a $5 scratch-off ticket once a week after she got her groceries at Normie's Super Shop. For years she'd been doing that and never won more than $20. Then one day in 04, she matched 27 below to 27 above on a big main million scratcher, and holy Christ on a bike, she seen that match was worth $250,000. "I thought I was going to pee my pants," she said. They put a picture in the window of the super shop. Well, you remember that. It was there for 2 months at least. A cool quarter million. More like $120,000 after all the taxes was paid, but still, we invested it in Sunny Oil because Ma said oil was always going to be a good investment, at least until it was gone, and we'd be gone by the time it was. I had to agree with that, and it turned out fine. Those were go-go years in the stock market, as you may remember, and that's when we commenced our life of leisure. It's also when we got down to serious drinking. Some of it we done at the house in town, but not that much. You know how neighbors love to gossip. It wasn't until we were mostly shifted out to the mosquito bowl that we really went to work on it. Ma quit the flower shop for good in 09, and I said toodaloo to patching tires and replacing mufflers a year or so later.
After that, we didn't have much reason to live in town, least until cold weather. No furnace out to the lake, you know. By 2012, when our trouble with those Dagos across the lake started, we'd roll on out there week or two before Memorial Day and stay until Thanksgiving or so. Ma put on some weight, 150 pounds, give or take. I guess a lot of that was down to the coffee brandy. They don't call it fat ass in a glass for nothing. But she said she was never the Miss America type to begin with, or even Miss Maine. "I'm a cuddly kind of gal," she liked to say. What Doc Stone liked to say, at least until she stopped going to him, was that she was going to be a dying young kind of gal if she didn't quit drinking the Allens. "You're a heart attack waiting to happen, Hallie," he said. "Or cirrhosis. You've already got type 2 diabetes. Isn't that enough for you?" "I can give it to you in words of one syllable. You need to dry out. Then you need AA. "Phew," Ma said when she got back. "After a scolding like that, I need a drink. What about you, Alden?" I said I could use one. So we took our lawn chairs out the end of the dock, as we most often did, and got royally schnockered while we watched the sun go down. Good as anyone, and better than many. "And look here, something's going to kill everyone. Am I not right? Doctors have a way of forgetting that, but Ma knew. The macrobiotic son of a bitch is probably right," she said as we tottered back to the cabin along about 10 this was, and both of us bit to shit in spite of the deep we'd slathered ourselves in. "But at least when I go, I'll know I lived. And I don't smoke. Everybody knows that's the worst. Not smoking should keep me going for a while, but what about you, Alden? What are you going to do after I die and the money runs out?" "Well, I don't know," I said. "I sure would like to see the Grand Canyon." She laughed and tossed an elbow in my ribs and said, "That's my boy. You'll never get a stomach ulcer with that attitude. Now let's get some sleep." Which we did, waking up around 10 the next day and starting to medicate our hangovers along about noon with muddy rudders. I didn't worry as much about Ma as the doc did. I figured she was having too much fun to die. As it happened, she outlived Doc Stone, who got killed one night by a drunk driver on Pigeon Bridge. You could call that irony, or tragedy, or just the way life goes. Me? I ain't no philosopher. I was just glad the doc didn't have his family with him, and I hope his insurance was paid up. All right, that's the background. Now here's where we get down to business. The Massimos. And that fucking trumpet, pardon my francais. I call it the 4th of July arms race. And although it didn't really get up and running till 2013, it really started the year before. The Massimos had the place directly across from us. Big white house with pillars and a lawn running down the beach, which was pure white sand instead of gravel like ours. That place must have had a dozen rooms, 20 or more if you count the guest cottage. They called it 12 Pines Camp, on account of the fir trees that was around the main house and kind of closed it in. A camp? Sunday Jesus, that place was a mansion. And yes, they had a tennis court, also badminton, and a place on the side for throwing horseshoes. They'd come out near the end of June and stay until Labor Day, and then close the son of a bitch up. A place that size, and they let it stand empty 9 months out of every 12. I couldn't believe it. Ma could, though. She said we were accident rich, but the Massimos were real rich. "Only those are ill-gotten gains, Alden," she said. "And I'm not talking about no quarter-acre pot patch either. Everyone knows Paul Massimo is connected." She always said it just like that, in big capital letters. Supposedly, the money came from Massimo Construction, I looked it up on the internet, and it appeared as legal as could be. But they were Italian, and Massimo Construction was based in Providence, Rhode Island. And your cops, you can connect them dots. As Ma always used to say, when you put two and two together, you never get five. They used all the rooms in the big white house when they were there, I'll say that much, and the ones in the guest cottage as well. Ma used to look across the water and toast them with her sombrero or muddy rudder and say, Massimo's come cheaper by the dozen. They knew how to have fun, I'll give them that. There were cookouts and water tag and teenage kids driving those jet skis around. They must have had a half a dozen of those babies in colors so bright they'd burn your eyes if you looked at them too long. In the evenings, they'd play touch football. Usually enough Massimos to make two regulation teams of 11 each. And then, when it got too dark to see the ball, they'd sing. You could tell by the way they yelled out their songs, often in Italian, they enjoyed a drink of three themselves. One of them had a trumpet, and he'd blow it along with the song. Just wah, 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 enough to make your eyes water. Dizzy Gillespie, he ain't, Ma said. Someone ought to dip that trumpet in olive oil and stick it up his ass. He could fart out God Bless America. Long about 11, he'd blow taps. That'd be it for the night. I'm not sure any of the neighbors would have complained, even if the singing and the trumpet had gone on until 3 in the morning, not when most of the folks on our side of the lake believed he was the real-life Tony Soprano. Come the 4th of July that year, this is 012 I'm talking about, I had some sparklers, 2 or 3 packets of Black Cat firecrackers, and a couple of cherry bombs. I bought them from Pop Anderson at Anderson's Cherry Flea Market on the road to Oxford. That ain't tattling, neither. Not unless you're bone stupid, and I know neither you is. Hell, everybody knew you'd get firecrackers at the Cherry Flea. The little stuff was all Papa never sell, because back then fireworks was against the law. Anyway, all those Massimos was running around across the lake, playing football and tennis and giving each other swimsuit wedges. The little ones paddling around the shore, the bigger ones diving off their float. Me and Ma was out the end of the dock in our lawn chairs, feeling no pain with our patriotic supplies laid out beside us. As dusk came down, I give her a sparkler, lit it, then lit mine off in hers. We waved 'em around in the gloaming. Pretty soon, the little ones over there on the other side seen 'em and started clamoring for their own. The two older Massimo boys handed 'em out, and they waved 'em back at us. Their sparklers was bigger and longer-lasting than ours, and the heads had been treated with some sort of chemical and made 'em go all different colors, while ours were only yellow-white. The dago with the trumpet blew wah, wah, as if to say, this is what real sparklers look like. That's okay, Ma said. The sparklers may be bigger, but let's shoot some firecrackers, see how they like that. We lit 'em, one by one, then tossed 'em so they'd bang and flash before they hit the lake. The kids over there at 12 Pines seen that and started clamoring again. So some of the Massimo men went into the house, come back with a carton. It was full of firecrackers. Pretty soon the bigger kids were lighting 'em off a pack at a time. They must have a couple hundred packs in all, and they went off like machine gun fire, which made ours seem pretty tame. Wah, wah, went the trumpet, as if to say, try again. Well, sugar tit, Ma said. Give me one of them cherry bumpers you've been holding back, Alden. All right, I said. But you be careful, Ma. You've had a few, and you might still like to see all your fingers tomorrow morning. Just give one over and don't be smart, she said. I didn't fall off a hayrick yesterday, and I don't like the sound of that trumpet. I bet they don't have any of these, 'cause Pop don't sell 'em to Flatlanders. He sees their license plates and claims he's all out. I gave her one and lit it with my Bic.
The fuse sparked, and she threw it high in the air. It went with a flash bright enough to hurt our eyes, and the bang echoed all the way down the lake. I let the other one and flung it like Roger Clemens. Bang! "There," Ma says. "Now they know who's boss." But then Paul Massimo and his two oldest sons walked down to the end of their dock. One of them, big, handsome young fella in a rugby shirt, had that goddamn trumpet in a kind of holster thing on his belt. They waved to us. Then the old man handed each of the boys something. They held the somethings out so he could light the fuses. They flung 'em out over the lake, and holy God, not bang, but boom! Two booms, loud as dynamite, and big white flashes. "Those ain't cherry bombs," I said. "Them are M-80s. "Where'd they get those?" Ma asked. "Pop don't sell those." We looked at each other. Didn't even have to say it. Rhode Island. You could probably get anything in Rhode Island. At least if your name was Massimo, you could. The old man handed each of them another and lit 'em up. Then he lit one of his own. Three booms loud enough to scare every fish in Abenaki up to the north end, I have no doubt. Then Paul waved to us, and the fellow with the trumpet drew it out of his holster like a six-gun and blew three long blasts. Wah, wah, wah. As if to say, "Sorry about that, you poor-ass Yankees. Better luck next year." Wasn't nothing we could do about it, neither. We had another pack of black cats, but they would have sounded pretty lackluster after those M-80s. And over on the other side, that pack of Dagos was applauding and cheering, the girls jumping up and down in their bikini suits. Pretty soon they started singing "God Bless America." Ma looked at me, and I looked at Ma. She shook her head, and I shook mine. Then she said, "Next year." "Yes," I said, "next year." She held up her glass. We were drinking Bucket Lux that night, as I recall, and I raised mine. We drank to victory in 013, and that was how the 4th of July arms race began. Mostly, I think it was that fucking trumpet. Pardon my Francais. The following June, I went to Pop Anderson and explained my situation. Told him how I felt the honor of us on the west side of the lake had to be upheld.
"Well, Alden," he said, "I don't know what shooting off a bunch of gunpowder has to do with honor, but business is business. And if you come back in a week or so, I might have something for you."
I did just that. He took me into his office and put a box on his desk. Had a bunch of Chinese characters on it.
"This is the stuff I ordinarily don't sell," he said. "But me and your ma goes all the way back to grammar school together, where she spelled me by the wood stove, helped me learn my times tables. I got you some big bangers they call M120s. There's not much bigger in the loud noise department unless you want to start tossing sticks of dynamite. Then there's a dozen of these." He brought out a cylinder sitting on top of a red stick. "That looks like a bottle rocket," I said, "only bigger." "Hey, you could call this the deluxe model," he said. "They're called Chinese peonies. They shoot twice as high, then make a hell of a flash, some red, some purple, some yellow. You stick 'em in a Coke or a beer bottle just like with ordinary bottle rockets, but you want to stand well back because the fuses are going to fizz sparks all over the place when they lift off. Keep a towel handy so you don't start any brush fires." "Well, that's great," I said. "They won't be blowing no trumpet when they see those." "I'll sell you the whole box for $30, Pop said. "I know that's dear. I also throwed in some black cats and a few Twizzlers. Stick those in chunks of wood and send them off floating. Awful pretty they are. Say no more, I told him. It'll be cheap at twice the price. Alden, he said, you never want to talk that way to a feller in my line of work. I took him back to camp, and Ma was so excited she wanted to set off one of the M120s and one of the Chinese peonies right away. I didn't often put my foot down with Ma. She was apt to bite it right off your ankle. But I did that time. Give those Massimos half a chance and they'll come up with something better, I said. She thought it over, then kissed me on the cheek and said, you know, for a boy who barely finished high school, you've got a head on your shoulders, Alden. So here come the glorious 4th of 013. The whole Massimo clan was gathered over to 12 Pines like usual. Must have been 24 or more. And me and Ma was out the end of our dock in our lawn chairs. We had our box of goodies set down between us, along with a good-sized pitcher of orange driver. Pretty soon, Paul Massimo come out the end of his dock with his own box of goodies, which was a bit bigger than ours, but that didn't concern me. It ain't the size of the dog in the fight, you know, but the size of the fight in the dog. His 2 grown boys was with him. They waved, and we waved back. Dusk commenced, and me and Ma started shooting off black cats. Not one by one this time, but by the pack. The little kids did the same over on their side. When they got tired of that, they lit up their big sparklers and waved them around. The sun, with the trumpet, blew a couple of times, kind of tuning up. A bunch of the younger ones heard it and come out on the 12 Pines dock, and after some talk, Paul and his grown boys handed each of them a big gray ball that I recognize as M-80s. Sound carries across a lake real well, especially when there's no breeze, and I could hear Paul telling the little ones to be careful and demonstrating how they was to chuck 'em out into the lake. Then Massimo lit 'em up. 3 of those kids threw high, wide, and handsome like they was supposed to, but the youngest couldn't have been more than 7, wound up like Nolan friggin' Ryan and chucked his right on the dock between his feet. It bounced and would have blown his nose off if Paul hadn't yanked him back. Some of the women screamed, but Massimo and his boys just fell down laughing. I judge they might have had more than a few shots. Wine, most likely, because that's what those dagos like to drink. All right, Ma said. Enough frigging around. Let's show 'em up before that tall one starts honking his goddamn horn. So I took out a couple of M120s, which were black and looked like the bombs you sometimes see in those old-time cartoons, the ones a villain uses to blow up the railroad tracks and gold mines and such. You be careful, Ma, I said. Hold on to something like this too long and you'd lose more than just your fingers. Don't you worry about me, she said. Let's show those spaghetti eaters. So I lit 'em, and we threw 'em, and kapow, one after the other. Enough to rattle windows all the way to Waterford, I should judge. Mr. Hornblower froze with his trumpet halfway to his lips. Some of the little kids started to cry. All the women ran down the beach to see what was going on, if it was terrorists or what. "Let's get 'em," Ma said, and she toasted to young Mr. Hornblower standing over there with his trumpet in his hand and his thumb up his ass. Not really, you know, but in a manner of speaking. Paul Massimo and his 2 sons walked back to the end of their dock, and there they huddled like a bunch of baseball players when the bases are loaded. Then they all walked up the house together. I thought they was finished. And Ma was sure of it. So we lit up our Twizzlers, just to celebrate. I'd cut squares of styrofoam from some packing material I found in the swill bucket out back of the cabin, and we stuck 'em in those and pushed 'em out on the water. By then it was that deep purple time that comes just before full dark. Awful gorgeous. with the wishing star up there in the sky, and all the others ready to peep out. Neither day nor night, and always the prettiest time there is. That's what I think. And them Twizzlers, they was a lot more than pretty. They was beautiful, floating out there, all red and green, waxing and waning like candle flames, and reflecting on the water. It was quiet again, too. So quiet you could hear the thumps of the fireworks show getting started over to Bridgeton Way. Plus, frogs started to croak again along the shoreline. The frogs thought all the noise and ruckus was over for the night. Little did they know, because just then, Paul and his two grown boys come back down to their dock and looked across at us. Paul had something in his hand almost as big as a softball, and the grown boy, without the trumpet, which made him the smarter of the two, in my opinion, lit him up. Massimo didn't waste time but slang it underhand, high above the water, and before I could tell Ma to cover her ears, it went off. Holy Jesus, the flash seemed to blot out the whole sky, and the blast was as loud as an artillery shell. This time, it wasn't just a Massimo women and girls who came to see, but damn near everybody on the lake. And although half of them probably pissed their pants when that fucker went off, they were applauding. Do you believe that? Ma and me looked at each other, because we knew what was coming next, and it surely did. Captain Hornblower raised his fucking trumpet and blew it at us, one long blast. All the Massimos laughed and applauded some more, and so did everyone else on both sides of the water. It was humiliating. You can understand that, can't you, Andy? Adele? We'd been out-exploded by a bunch of I-Tai Flatlanders from Rhode Island. Not that I don't like a plate of spaghetti myself from time to time, but every day, get out. All right, fine. Ma said, squaring her shoulders. Maybe they can outbang us, but we got those Chinese peonies. Let's see how they like those. But I could see on her face that she felt they might get the best of us there, too. I set up a dozen beer and soda cans on the end of our dock and slipped one of the peonies into each one. The Massimo menfolk over on the other side stood watching us. Then the one who didn't think he could play the trumpet run back the house for fresh ammunition. Meanwhile, I ran my lighter along the fuses, neat as you please, and the Chinese peonies took off, one after the other, with nary a malfunction. Awfully pretty they were, even though they didn't last long. All the colors of the rainbow, just like Pop promised. There were oohs and ahs from some of the Massimos, I'll give them that. And then the young man who ran away come back from his errand with another box. Turned out it was full of fireworks that were like our Chinese peonies, only bigger. Each one had its own little cardboard launching pad. We could see because by then, those lights on at the end of the Massimo dock, kind of shaped like torches, only electric. Paul lit those rockets, and up they went, making golden starbursts in the sky that was twice as big and bright as ours. They twinkled and made crackling machine gun noises when they came down. Everybody applauded even more. And, of course, me and Ma had to do the same, or we'd be thought of as poor sports. And the trumpet blew. Wah, wah, wah. Later on, after we'd shot off all our shit, Ma went stomping around the kitchen in her nightgown and tartan slippers, steam practically shooting out of her ears. "Where'd they get armaments like that?" she asked. But it was what you call a rhetorical question. She didn't give me time to answer. "From his hoodlum friends back in Rhode Island, that's where. Because he's connected, and he's one of those people who got to win at everything. You can tell just looking at him." Sort of like you, Ma, I thought, but did not say. Sometimes silence really is golden, and never more than when your ma's loaded on Allen's coffee brandy and madder than a wet hen. And I hate that friggin' trumpet. I hate it with a purple passion.
I could agree with her there, and did. She grabbed me by the arm, slopping her last drink of the night all down the front of my shirt.
Next year, she said, we're going to show 'em who's boss next year. Promise me we'll shut up that trumpet in 14, Alden.
I promised to try. That was the best I could do. Paul Massimo had all his resources in Rhode Island, and what did I have? Pop Anderson, owner of a side-of-the-road flea market next to the discount sneaker store. Still, I went to him the next day and explained what had happened. He listened and did me the courtesy of not laughing, although his mouth twitched a few times. I'm willing to sniculate that it did have its funny side, at least until last night it did. But not so much when you had Hallie McCausland breathing down your neck.
Yes, I could see how that would get your ma's goat, Pop said. She was always a hella when somebody tried to get the best of her. But for Christ's sake, Alden, it's only fireworks. When she sobers up, she'll see that.
I don't think so, I said, not wanting to add that Ma never really sobered up anymore. Just went from tiddly to crocked to asleep to hungover and then back to tiddly again. Not that I was much better. It ain't so much the fireworks as it is that trumpet, you see. If she could shut up that fucking trumpet on the 4th of July, I think she'd be satisfied.
Well, I can't help you, Pop said. There's plenty of bigger fireworks out there for sale, but I won't truck in them. I don't want to lose my vendor's license, for one thing, and I don't want to see no one get hurt, that's another. Drunk shooting explosives is always a recipe for disaster. But if you're really determined, you ought to take a ride up to Indian Island and talk to a fella there. Great big Penobscot named Howard Gamash. Biggest goddamn Indian in Maine, maybe in the whole world. Rides a Harley Davidson and has feathers tattooed on his cheeks. He's what you might call connected. Somebody connected. That's exactly what we needed. I thanked Pop and wrote the name Howard Gamash in my notebook. And next April, I took a ride up to Penobscot County with $500 cash in the glove box of my truck. I found Mr. Gamash sitting at the bar of the Harvest Hotel in Old Town, and he was as big as advertised. 6'8", I'd guess, and would dress out around 350, as the hunters say. He listened to my tale of woe, and after I'd bought him a pitcher of Bud, which he drank down in less than 10 minutes, he said,
"Well, Mr. McCausland, let's you and me take a little jaunt up the road to my wigwam and discuss this in more detail."
He was riding a Harley Softail, which is a mighty big sled. But when he was on it, that thing looked like one of the little bikes a clowns ride in the circus. Butt cheeks hung right down to the saddlebags, they did. His wigwam turned out to be a nice little two-story ranch with a pool out back for the kiddies, of which he had a passel. No, Adele, the bike and the pool ain't particularly important to the story. But if you want it, you'll have to take it my way. And I find it interesting. There was even a home theater set up in the basement. Jeez, like crow, I felt like moving in. The fireworks was in his garage, under a tap, all stacked up in wooden crates, and there was some pretty awesome stuff.
"If you get caught with it," he said, "you never heard of Howard Gamash. Isn't that right?"
I said it was, and because he seemed like an honest enough fella who wouldn't screw me, at least not too bad, I asked him what $500 would buy. I ended up getting mostly cakes, which are blocks of rockets with a single fuse. You light it, and up they go by the dozen. There was 3 cakes called Pyro Monkey, another 2 called Declaration of Independence, 1 called Psychodelic,
that shoots off in big bursts of light that look like flowers, and one that was extra special. I'll get to that. You think this stuff will shut down those Dagos? I asked him.
You bet, Howard said. Only as someone who prefers to be called a Native American rather than a Redskin or Tomahawk Tom, I don't care much for such pejorative terms as Dago, Bog Trotter, Camel Jockeys, and Beaners. They are Americans, even as you and I, and there's no need to denigrate them.
I hear you, I said, and I'll take it to heart, but those Massimos still piss me off, and if that offends you, it's a case of tough titty, said the kitty.
Understood, and I can fully identify with your emotional condition. But let me give you some advice, Paleface. Keep 'em to speed limit going home. You don't want to get caught with that shit in your trunk.
When Ma saw what I'd bought, she shook her fist over her head and then poured us a couple of dirty hubcaps to celebrate. When they experience these, they're gonna shit nickels, she said. Maybe even silver dollars, see if they don't.
Only it didn't turn out that way. I guess you know that, don't you?
Come 4th of July last year, Abenaki Lake was lauded to the gunnels. Word had got round, you see, that it was the McCausland Yankees against the Massimo Dagos for the fireworks blue ribbon. Must have been 600 people on our side of the lake. Not so many over on their side, but there was a bunch all right, more than ever before. Every Massimo east of the Mississippi must have shown up for the 014 showdown. We didn't bother with piddling stuff like firecrackers and cherry bombs that time. Just waited for deep dusk so we could shoot the big stuff. Ma and me had boxes with Chinese characters stacked on our dock, but so did they. The east shore front was lined with little Massimos waving sparklers. Looked like stars that had fallen to earth, they did. I sometimes think sparklers are enough, and this morning I sure wish we'd have stuck to 'em. Paul Massimo waved to us. We waved back. The idiot with the trumpet blew a long blast. Wah! Paul pointed to me as if to say, "You first, Monsieur." So I shot off a pyro monkey. It lit up the sky, and everyone went, "Ah!" Then one of Massimo's sons lit off something similar, except it was brighter and lasted longer. The crowd went, "Ooh!" And off went the fucking trumpet. "Never mind the funky monkeys or whatever they are," Ma said. "Give them the Declaration of Independence. That'll show 'em."
I did, and it was some gorgeous. But those goddamn Massimos topped that one, too. They topped everything we shot off. And every time theirs went brighter and louder, that asshole blew his trumpet. It pissed off mind me no end. Hell, it was enough to piss off the Pope. The crowd got one hell of a fireworks show that night, probably as good as the one they have in Portland, and I'm sure they went home happy. But there was no joy on the dock of the Mosquito Bowl, I can tell you that. Ma usually gets happy when she's in the bag, but she wasn't that night. It was full dark by then, all the stars out, and a haze of gunpowder drifting across the lake. We was down to our last and biggest item. "Shoot it," Ma said, "and see if they can beat it. Might as well. But if he blows that friggin' trumpet one more time, my head's gonna explode right off of my shoulders." Our last one, the extra special, was called the Ghost of Fury, and Howard Gamache swore by it.
"A beautiful thing," he told me, "and totally illegal. Stand back after you light it, Mr. McCausland, because it goes a gusher."
Goddamn fuse was thick as your wrist. I lit it and stood back. For a few seconds after it burned down, there was nothing, and I thought it was a dud. Well, don't that just impregnate the family dog, Ma said. Now he'll blow that bastardly trumpet. But before he could, the ghost of fury went off. First, it was just a fountain of white sparks. But then it shot up higher and turned rose pink. It started blowing off rockets that exploded in starbursts. By then the fountain of sparks on the end of our dock was at least 12 feet high and bright red. It shot off even more rockets straight up into the sky, and they boomed as loud as a squadron of jets breaking the sound barrier. Ma covered her ears, but she was laughing fit to split. The fountain went down, then spurted up one last time like an old man in a whorehouse, Ma said, and shot off this gorgeous red and yellow flower into the sky. There was a moment of silence. Odd, don't you know? And then everybody on the lake started applauding like crazy. Some people who was in the campus tooted their horns, which sounded mighty thin after all those bangs. The Massimos was applauding too, which showed they was good sports, which impressed me. Because, you know, folks who have to win at everything usually ain't. The one with the trumpet never took the damn thing out of its holster. "We did it!" Ma shouted. "Alden, give your Ma a kiss!" I did, and when I looked across the lake, I seen Paul Massimo standing at the end of his dock in the light of those electric torches they had. He put up one finger as if to say, "Wait and watch." It gave me a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. The sun without the trumpet, the one I judge might have a lick of sense, put down a launcher cradle, slow and reverent, like an altar boy putting out the Holy Communion. Setting in it was the biggest fucking rocket I ever seen that wasn't on TV at Cape Canaveral. Paul dropped down on one knee and put his lighter to the fuse. As soon as it started to spark, he grabbed both his boys and ran 'em right off the dock. There was no pause, like with our ghost of fury. Fucker took off like Apollo 19, trailing a streak of blue fire and turned purple and then red. A second later, the stars was blotted out by a giant flaming bird that covered the lake almost from one side to the other. It blazed up there, then exploded. And I'll be damned if little birds didn't come out of the explosion, shooting off in every direction. The crowd went nuts. Them grown boys was hugging their father and pounding him on the back and laughing. "Let's go in, Alden," Ma said. She never sounded so sad since Daddy died. "We're beat." "We'll get 'em next year," I said, patting her shoulder. "Now," she said, "them Massimos will always be a step ahead. That's the kind of people they are. People with connections. We're just a couple of poor folks living on a lucky fortune, and I guess that'll have to be enough." As we went up the steps of our shitty little cabin, there come one final trumpet blast from the fine big house across the lake. "Wah!" Made my head ache, it did. Howard Gamache told me that last firework was called the Rooster of Destiny. He said he'd seen videos of them on YouTube, but always with people talking Chinese in the background.
"How this Massimo gentleman got it into this country is a mystery to me," Howard said. This was about a month later, toward the end of last summer, when I finally got up enough ambition to make the drive up to his two-story wigwam on Indian Island and tell him what happened. How we give 'em a good battle, but still come off on the short end when all was said and told. "It's no mystery to me," I said. "His friends in China probably threw it in as an extra with his last load of opium, you know, little gift to say, thanks for doing business with us. Have you got anything that'll top it? I mean, Ma's awful depressed, Mr. Gamache.
She don't want to compete next year. But I was thinking, if there was anything, you know, the topper, to top all toppers, well, I'd pay as much as $1,000. It'd be worth it just to see my ma smiling on 4th of July night. Howard sat on his back steps with his knees sticking up around his ears like a couple of boulders. God, what a mighty man he was, and thought about it, cogitated on it, judged his way around it. At last he said,
I have heard rumors.
Rumors about what?
About a special something called Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, from a fellow I correspond with on the subject of gunpowder amusements. His native name is Shining Path, but mostly he goes by Johnny Parker. He's a Cayuga Indian, and he lives near Albany, New York. I could give you his email address, but he won't reply unless I email him first and tell him you're safe. Will you do that, I asked? Of course, he said, but first you must pay he big wumpum pale face. $50 should do it.
Money passed from my small hand to his big one. He emailed Johnny Shining Path Packer, and when I got back to the lake and sent him an email of my own, he answered right back. But he wouldn't talk about what he called CE4, except in person. Claimed the government read all Native American emails as a matter of course. I didn't have no argument with that. I bet those suckers read everybody's email. So we agreed to meet, and long about the 1st of October last year, I went up. Of course, Ma wanted to know what sort of errand would take me all the way to upstate New York, and I didn't bother telling her no made-up story, because she always sees through 'em and has since I was knee-high to a collie. She just shook her head. Go on, if it'll make you happy, she said. But you know they'll come back with something even bigger. We'll be stuck listening to that eye-tie cock-knocker blowing his trumpet. Well, maybe, I said. But Mr. Shining Pass says this is the